I would like to echo the comments that have been made already about particularly my thankfulness for your presence this evening. We all know there's a lot of other things you'd be doing on a Friday night than gathering here with the saints, but you've chosen to be here, and as has already been said, that's very encouraging. I appreciate your presence. I know the others do too. I would particularly like also to extend my thanks to the elders of this congregation for giving me the opportunity to speak to you this evening, and I feel it an honor and privilege to be grouped in with so many other capable speakers, as I've heard before. And hopefully the things I will say this evening will strengthen your mind, strengthen your resolve in our God as the Creator. So, God was once approached by a scientist who said, "Listen, God, we've decided we really don't need you anymore. These days, we can clone people, successfully transplant organs, and do all sorts of things that used to be considered miraculous." God replied, "You don't need me, huh? How about we put your theory to the test? Why don't we have a competition to see who can make a person from scratch? Let's say a male human being." The scientist agrees, so God declares that they should do it like he did in the good old days when he created Adam. "Fine," says the scientist, as he bends down to pick up a handful of dirt. "Whoa," says God, shaking his head. "Not so fast. You get your own dirt." I make these statements in jest, of course, but the sad reality is that, like our scientist friend in the anecdote, people often find themselves not needing God. We live in an age where people think, because of our technological advancements, that we've got it all figured out. People think they can write God out of history because they found a better way. We can answer all the questions without the need for a creator. This brings us to tonight's first lesson. Throughout the span of the Bible, individuals are asked to make the single most important decision that they will ever make. No matter their choice, the answer to this question requires but a single word: yes or no. Yet, as simple as it will be to utter this small word, the ramifications of that answer could not be more complex or profound. Do you believe? The question is no different today. Some 2,000 years have passed since the last pen stroke was made in the collection of books that we know today as the Holy Bible. But the circumstances have not changed. Time has not altered our standing in the universe. Mankind is still asked to make this the most basic of decisions. Do you believe? Yes or no? Do you believe? Do I believe? Do I believe what? Do I believe in Jesus? That's not the question. It's more basic than that. Do I believe in a mortal soul, an eternal judgment? Still, more basic. The single most important decision that an individual will ever make in this life is to decide, do I believe in God? All other decisions in life are a subset of this question, and how you choose to answer it will directly impact all other choices in life. If you choose no, then the following can be said: you have accepted that this life is all there is, and that your choices will not matter after your heart stops beating. You can live your life however you see fit within the confines of secular authority. You are content to accept that there is no satisfactory answer to the question, how or why are we here? Or alternatively, you place your faith in such ideas as the theory of the Big Bang and Darwinism, thus concluding that there is no purpose for our being, we just are. My goal tonight is to address the notion of disbelief in God specifically as the Creator. Of course, there are many ways this topic could be approached, but for this study, I will focus on the evidences of grand design that exist in this amazing world around us. I will attempt to show how the unique harmony and finite balance of this planet point to a great architect and a singular mind. As the claim is made in Hebrews 3:4, every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. I mentioned a few moments ago the concept of the unbeliever's faith in entities other than an almighty God. I know we would typically use the word faith in a religious context, but do not be mistaken. If you choose not to believe in God, then you are choosing to believe in something else. And by default, you must place your faith in that something. I defer once again to the book of Hebrews, this time for the definition of faith. Hebrews 11:1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, does God expect us to believe in Him without cause? Are we to have blind faith like that of a child? Are we to trust in Him just because someone said to? I contend that the answer is a resounding no. And those that would teach such are robbing the Lord of His power. While God does not speak directly to us like the prophets of old, His mighty creation resides all about us and can speak to us with just as much impact as if we were to commune with the Almighty Himself. The simple fact is that our daily lives are inundated with God's creation. You quite literally cannot escape it. When is the last time you successfully breathed something other than oxygen? How about just defying gravity the next time you drop a glass on the tile in the kitchen to avoid that issue? Maybe replace all of your water usage with, I don't know, sulfuric acid. I'm sure that'll work out well for you. Our bodies and everything in this planet are made to function a certain way, to take advantage of the available elements, to survive in the conditions present on this rock. But just how fragile is this system? Let's take a step back and view our world as it travels through space. Over the past decade or so, a real hot topic in our media has been the concept of global warming. The idea that our, meaning humans, actions relating to fossil fuel consumption are of such a scale that the resulting pollutants are magnifying the greenhouse effect of our atmosphere and actually raising the global temperature. And somewhere in there is a lot of tears shed for polar bears and beach houses lost, but I digress. We know that our planet is positioned a certain distance from the sun, and it is because of this that our surface temperatures are conducive to supporting life. But how much or how little would this distance need to change to start to cause us some serious problems? Consider this. All life as we know it relies on the existence of water to survive. But not just the compound we call H2O. We specifically require water in its liquid form. In other words, we are able to survive here because the temperature ranges on our planet predominantly fall between the freezing point of water, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and the boiling point of water, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. If the Earth were only 5% closer to the sun, we would experience an unrestrained greenhouse effect similar to what we see on Venus. And the water would evaporate, all liquid water would evaporate, and the life would cease to exist. 5% closer. If we were but 20% farther away from the sun, the temperature would drop to a level at which all water, the miles-deep oceans, underground water, everything, would freeze like we see on Mars, and life would cease to exist. Do you often wake up in the morning and thank God for the day? Have you ever thought to thank Him that the day is 24 hours long? Consider this. The fact that our planet takes approximately 24 hours to make one complete revolution has a tremendous impact on the moderation of our surface temperature and thus our ability to survive here. For example, we're approaching the time of year when it would not be unheard of here in Houston to experience a 40-degree temperature swing during the course of a single day. Perhaps it's 40 degrees in the early morning whenever you go to work, but near 80 degrees by late afternoon upon your return. We've all experienced this, running the heater in the morning and the AC at on the way home. Now imagine if our day, our 24-hour span, were stretched far beyond that 24-hour period. What would happen? Well, the cool side of the earth would spend more time in darkness and thus be allowed to cool even more, whereas the warm side would stay in sunlight for a longer period, thus allowing it to grow warmer than what we would consider normal. Let's take this to the extreme by looking at some real temperature numbers from one of our neighboring planets, Mercury. Now, there are a couple of key facts about Mercury that are relevant to our study here. Number one, as you're all sure aware, Mercury is the closest planet to our solar system and to the sun. And in fact, it is only about a third the distance from the sun to Mercury as it is from the sun to our own planet. So, naturally, you would expect for Mercury to experience much higher temperatures on its surface than we do. And, of course, you'd be right. Around its equator, the temperature of the surface of Mercury can reach a stifling 800 degrees Fahrenheit. To put this into perspective, the melting temperature of lead is only about 620 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, Levi, so what? We all had third grade science class, and we know that it's hot on Mercury. Well, here's the so what. Do you know how long a solar day lasts on Mercury? It turns out that the amount of time it takes for Mercury to make one full rotation, or in other words, for one solar day to pass, is 176 earthen days. That's almost half a year. So, because of this extremely slow rotation, a very interesting phenomenon occurs on Mercury. Can you guess what it is? We just talked about how hot it gets on Mercury, but what about how cold? Remember the big 40-degree temperature swings that we mentioned here in Houston? Well, how about a fluctuation of over 1,000 degrees? On the dark side of Mercury, the temperature can drop to below negative 280 degrees Fahrenheit. For comparison, the lowest naturally occurring temperature that has been recorded on the face of our own planet was recorded in 1983 in Antarctica at a measly minus 128 degrees Fahrenheit. Try to wrap your head around this. It actually gets far colder on Mercury, which is practically touching the sun, than it does on our own planet, largely because of the difference in rotational speed. Thanks be to God for the length of our days. And just for comparison, if our planet matched the rotational velocity of one of our other neighboring planets, Jupiter, the Earth would spin so fast that we would literally be flung off the face of this rock. And people think that we're here by chance? How can this be? We are the perfect distance from the sun, spinning at just the right speed, with the right combination of gaseous elements to produce and maintain an atmosphere. All of these aspects combine to maintain the moderate temperatures that are conducive to supporting life. Our unique position in the universe is so exact and so sensitive to change, it's almost ridiculous. Psalms 33, verse 6 says, "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast." So we've perhaps looked at the big picture, if you will. Let's zoom back in and make this discussion more personal. What about us? What about you, me, people? Is our entire being not perfectly adapted for this place? Let's look at a few aspects of our own minds and bodies that might give us a clue as to where we came from. Consider our ability to process oxygen so quickly and efficiently. Scientists say that a very healthy human can capture and retain more than 50% of the oxygen they breathe in with air. This occurs all within seconds, and you don't even have to think about it. Your lungs process the oxygen and your blood carries it to the areas that require it. And it's not just humans. Almost every living organism on this planet requires oxygen to survive. I sure hope we don't run out. Oh, wait. I guess it's a coincidence that we live on a planet covered in plants that not only produce more oxygen than we can consume, but also use our exhaust gases in the process. Oh, and they take full advantage of that distance to the sun thing too. Genesis 2:7, and the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Consider the cells of your body. Even the most simple cell is a miniature factory that carries out reproduction, energy production, repair, and security. Human life begins from two cells, which blend half of the DNA from the mother and the father into one new cell. Within the nucleus of every cell in higher life forms is 1 gigabyte of coded information. The human body is made up of 75 trillion cells. That's 12 zeros, if you're wondering. Every 3 seconds, 50,000 cells die, and they're replaced by 50,000 new ones. This is all controlled by the programmed instructions contained within an individual's DNA. Which begs the question, who did the programming? Matthew 10:30 says, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Every cell in our body is a testament to the existence and the supreme mind of God. Consider the concept of a conscience. Why do all humans have at least some level of morals? Humans seem to have a natural sense of right and wrong. This characteristic is unique to people. We do not see this type of trait in animals. They do not feel guilt. The shark does not show remorse for the devastation that it causes the seal. The chimpanzee feels no sense of moral duty or need to demonstrate reverence, but human beings do. Who then encoded our moral compass? Job 32:8, but there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. And according to Genesis 3 and other parts of the book, since the fall of man, mature humans have been granted the knowledge of good and evil. I made these observations this evening with the hope that either your resolve will be strengthened in God the Almighty as the Creator and Sustainer, or if you are currently an unbeliever, that I may cause you to fully consider the abundance of evidences that bombard you every day you walk on this earth. Evidences that can only point to an intelligent designer, a grand architect. So the question comes back to you. It comes to me. Do you believe? I leave you with a few verses to contemplate and the lesson will be yours. In the very beginning of the book that we call the Bible, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Psalm 139:14, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. And then, of course, the very familiar passage of Joshua 24. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, and then I insert, or the gods of modern science. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I thank you for your time and attention.